world, you know, the planets, and we send people to that. We agree to the fact that maybe the moon might be round, Mars might be round, and all this. We still call them what? Plates. You can check your dictionary from Greek. Planets takes its root from plate. That's why we call our, where we eat, plates. Okay, let me open a parenthesis on this level. So, if in this world we come in seeking knowledge, what knowledge is about is that you start one time thinking the world is one way. You live according to that. You find out better, and then what do? You readjust your living to fit what you know. Okay. You get the point. We're getting there slowly. Five years ago, throughout history of humanity, it was clear that a group, for now, let's use the common generic, that me personally, I don't like using, because it's not like that. But hey, they enjoy it, so let's call them that. I mean, white man. White man decided that he has finished conquering the world. He is tired of the fact that he'd been a follower. He is tired of that. So he decided, you know what? Let's set a date. From now on, this is the beginning of our world. That's why the year one become one. So whenever you say 2005 years, you are in 2005. What that means, 2005, I mean the system we live in, officially was born 2005 years ago. Now let's see how we can substantiate that. Okay. Now we have a Gregorian calendar, we have a Julian calendar. Okay. Very interesting. Keep in mind the fact that today we're trying to talk about the concept of time. You know, how time is perceived and how it affects our life. So, why again did we go from Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar? We know that in the year 2005 years ago, the Julian calendar was presented, you know, with the authority of the, you know, Vatican and all this, the Pope Julian. It was presented to humanity that this is the exact way of counting time. Because in that, you can still find it in the archive, that with the Julian calendar, they proudly said that this calendar will be only off or late of 1 hour every 10,000 years. Every 10,000 years. Okay. If it will be late for 1 hour every 10,000 years. Okay. 1,600 years later, they have to change it. And the reason was that already around 1300, already the Julian calendar was so late that you have under authority of the Pope they will decree. If today is what? What is today? Friday, Saturday in a Gregorian calendar, then you will receive an order. You know what? Today is Saturday, what, 30th of April. Okay, tomorrow will be Wednesday, the April 29th. Hey, you can check it. We're talking people's life here. This is not something to joke. You can check it yourself. So, by decree, the time concept have been changing by decree. I would say somebody certain, because already around this time, already the days, January was in the middle of summer, and July was in the middle of winter. So they end up in their own contradiction and decided that they will have to come up with something better. This is politics. That has nothing to do with time. It has nothing to do with humanity. It has nothing to do with a human mind, but everything to do with the power struggle in humanity. That's what is very hard for the individual to understand. So, now we find ourselves with a Gregorian calendar. Even when the Gregorian calendar was introduced, it comes now say, oh, now this is the most perfect calendar you can ever have. And for that, they say, with that one, you will, this calendar will get late only 1 second every 10,000 years. That's very, very, very perfect, right? 1 second every 10,000 years? That's very, 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 very perfect. Now, let's follow it and see. If you ask the average individual what is the length of the day, they will tell you it's 24 hours, right? Okay. Now, then you get through calculation, try to see what is the length of the day. And even now, this you can check it yourself too. Astronomically speaking, the day is 11 hours, 56 minutes, 44 seconds. Up to now, this is public domain. This is nothing special. It's just when you are put in a situation of a consumer, you don't question, all this. This you can find it everywhere, from your internet to your dictionary or whatever. Now, let's see. Are you following me?
Yeah.
Now, let's see the interesting thing here. If you look here, what do you get? You get 3 minutes and how many seconds? 16 seconds. So, 3 minutes and 16 seconds. First, my first approach was the politics and the religion. Now we add in the scientific approach. The scientific approach is very clear. The average day is this long, 23 hours. 23 hours. So up to now, we have a very, very, basic. Now we're mixing the science. You know, this mighty science man, the one that has...
And you've actually been listening to some excerpts from this 2-DVD set that we're offering you today, provided by the Earth Center, and it is the Sidereal Calendar and Traditional Time Division Lecture. The 2-DVD set is $110, pledge of support for WBAI. And he lays the foundation for understanding the original reason and techniques for keeping time. Remember, I'm just playing you excerpts. And he also exposes the contradictions and politics in the modern system, methods of timekeeping. He also lays the foundation for understanding the original reason and techniques for keeping time. And so it's a great coming to a great understanding of the original time system, which is the 1,400-year cycle of Septet, the Sirius star. So I'm going to go to, I think it might be interesting to try to hear a little bit more from the perspective of this Kemet clock, and because we're running low on time, and I do need for you to make your phone call at 212-209-2950. I want to play this segment on the Kemet clock, hopefully before, you know, we have to finish with the program. But the number is 212-209-2950.
We have this word, Merhet. Merhet in Medumai. What is the Merhet? The Merhet is a machine that we use to count time. But how do we do that? Because just like how we were explaining the notion of rhythms on the first part of the talk, we have a problem with that. Because really, the celestial bodies only gives us rhythm. We said that. But there's a problem with the celestial bodies too. The fact that we don't necessarily see them every time, you see? Clouds, dust, and things like this. So we have to come up with a way to try to pinpoint positions of these celestial bodies in the sky, you see? It's very interesting. Now, I don't know how to put you this, but that might come as a shocker. Did you notice that the watches you have, or whatever, the clocks are like this, they have arms? Okay. But before we head to that, you have to understand the position of the Earth in space. If this is the Earth, down here, that's the North Pole, and up here is the South Pole. So, and our name for the North Pole is Mecht. And Mecht for us means the drowned part. Drown. And then we have here what we call the rest or result, which is the South Pole, because this part is drowned and this part has what? Land on it. So remember the idea that normally you can't put water above the land, but if this pole is drowned, it's because this is the up. You see? So if this the south part is the up, so which means really the universe is in the south. I mean the source of the universe is in the south. So everything we do, that's why if you're facing south, we call the name we have for the east is Yabtet, or almost like the same word for the left. You see? And then we have the imantet here, the West, the right, the West, you know, the West or the right. So which means even the positioning on this planet is dictated by the whole universe. A human being faces south when he's looking for his origin. A human being faces south. If gods exist, they must be in the south, because even the planet faces south. Does that make sense? If the world of the gods exists, it's on the south. That's how, I mean, here I'm saying if, but for us it's a known fact. Because by observing that, when the physical appearance of the earth shows it, one pole is drowned and one pole is up. And the drowned pole cannot be placed above the land. Okay. Now, based on this positioning, now it's very simple. Remember, if this is the equator, the poles are really hard to be inhabited. We don't inhabit the poles. Why? Because it's too cold. It's so too cold. Nights that take 6 months, which kind of person want to live there unless they have no choice? Because if I have a choice, even we here, Chicago is too cold for me. I don't know about you. If we had a choice, if there's no things that keeps us here, we all will be where you don't need to be wearing, you know, so much clothes on yourself. So, again, now you notice that people of color, where do they inhabit? In the equatorial areas, where it is warmer. Because white man is simply a newcomer. That's why he had to deal with living in the places where, you know, we don't want to live there. We just don't want to live there unless we have to. Now, let's come down to the astronomy factor. So the Merhet, that's the name for the clock. You see, and keep in mind that up to now, there is no European nation that has a name for a clock. In French, it's montre, which means what you look at. In English, it's a clock or a watch. Hey, watch, what you look at, or a clock, because it makes a sound, clock, 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 clock. And you can go everywhere, all this. It's because even that instrument, it's not part of their culture, you know. Because when it came, they discovered it first. Yes, they'll make lines to go watch it. Wow, this is what you watch. Let's call it watch. And in French, oh, that's what you watch. Let's show it to them. Let's call it montre. They even call it, in some places they call it réveil, like what wakes you up. Because there's no name for it. So, the Merhet is the name for the clock or the watch or what you watch. Okay, now there's a problem. We remember this up to now, before the Earth Center gets involved in the picture, there was a notion that there was, black people, they don't even know how to write. So they don't know astronomy. They don't know all this. We have gods of hours. We have gods of the days, gods of hours, gods of the months. We have all that. We even have names of hours. What I mean, if I want to talk about this moment now, we have a name for it. Now tell me we don't know astronomy. Tell me we don't know astronomy. The maximum even the scientific field came up with is morning, noon, evening, right? And middle of the night, midnight. Is there a name for the second hour of the morning? Is there a name for the third hour? We even have names for the first hour of the day, plus the gods of that hour of the day and the goddesses of that hour of the day and all. Now you're telling me I'm the one that don't know astronomy. even up to 100 A.D., the Romans decided that, well, you know, they transforming the calendar, the time of, you know, the calendar and all this, they need to transform more because about conquering the world, turning it into your image. That's what it is about. So they decided that the fact that a day is 24 hours, that's too much. So nights shouldn't count. For those who remember, those who study history, they will tell you that there was a time where a day, by the order of the Pope, a day was just 12 hours. Like when the sun set and you go, you finish, time don't count anymore. We went through that. There was a time we've seen even worse. Did you notice that, wait a minute, we have months in the Gregorian calendar. We have January, February, March, April. There's a reason why I'm saying their name. Please, I'm going to start again. Listen carefully. January, February, March, April, May, June, July, and then what? August. And then September. September from Latin came from the word seven. So, seventh month, September. October, eighth month.
Right.
October, 8 months.
November.
November, ninth month.
Right.
Tenth month.
Right.
As I recall, when we put 12, it's supposed to mean December, right? Right? September is what? Ninth month, right? Isn't that interesting that you never question that? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting that look at how you brought up to think you are so much of a smart person and you never go home? How come the ninth month is called seventh month? The eighth month is called what? Tenth month. And then the ninth month is called 11th. And the 12th month is called the 10th. Okay, let's talk about you. You are just considered a victim, a consumer. You don't have to deal with it. What about the science? What about those who tell us they know everything about the speed of blah, blah, the planets and like this? They use the same words. They are the ones that call themselves astrophysics, astro that, astro this. They know everything. I didn't make these words, did I? Now, the alarming point is that you used that all your life and it didn't hit you. Going, something is going on, you see? We all know that even August was name of a pope. Okay. Was the one before August?
July.
Another pope. June. Who knows? May, February, and all this. So, when we're talking to you about the fact that even your idea of time is the symbol of white man's control, you got it now? You got it now? So, while you go saying, oh, I'm counting time, I'm this, I'm that, he's there saying, wow, I took these people from their bush and killed them and all this. Now look, they worship me. They worship everything about me. You see, that's a problem. And believe me, what I'm saying here, I'm not xenophobic. That has nothing to do with hating people, but evil should be fought wherever it came from, you know. Evil should be fought. I don't mind about accepting you, but shouldn't it be fair for you to accept me too? If I have to accept you the way you are, I think I should expect you to give me the same. That's all why we're talking about all this. Okay.
And we're running out of time, sadly, for me to play any more of this for you. But it's a kind of an amazing, it's really quite an amazing 2-DVD set. And we're talking about the Sidereal Calendar 2-DVD set for your pledge of $110. That's 212-209-2950. And hopefully you will catch up. We haven't had any pledges for the last half an hour because I was playing the information for you. I was hoping to give you enough material to encourage you to show your support. It's really important for you to do that at this time. And now is your opportunity to call. We're only going for, it looks like, another 6 minutes of the program. So please do make that phone call at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 is your number to call. And I will just let you know that you are listening to an extended special program. This is Heart of Mind. I'm Catherine Davis. Normally, you would hear this program on Mondays at 1 p.m. I'm doing a late special to introduce to you and to really reach out for your support by offering you something a little bit different than the mainstream, a little bit different than the what we usually hear. And, you know, this is Black History Month, allegedly the month that we are here to celebrate the culture of African American people, black people. Well, first, I'm not sure about the name African. I studied for a brief time with the Earth Center, and I learned that this word Africa is actually a word created as a curse. It means burning souls. Afri is burning, Ka is soul. So it was part of the colonization process of the continent that is in, through the Dogon cosmogony, is Merata. I mean, we also know it as Kemet. Kush. There are many names for the civilizations of the continent known as Africa, but we've been cut off from that history. And this is an opportunity to really dive back into the truth of who we are as a humanity. We started this program with Master Naba telling us that, you know, this is about humanity, because those people who engage in oppression, those people who engage in racism, those people who engage in division and exploitation are also suffering because they've lost their humanity. And those of us on the inside of that struggle have also lost a connection to our humanity, because we've lost the knowledge of who we truly are as beings. And in fact, we are all human beings. We're not black, white, brown, yellow, and all the different colors of our hues. We're need to connect to who we are as human beings. And the way to do that is to acknowledge the truth of human history and not the rewrite that we got as a result of the Nicene councils and the rewrite of the faith and the oppression of true knowledge and, you know, the burning of books, the crusades in which people were tortured and destroyed and so many horrific things happened in the name of allegedly spreading Christianity, but what it was really doing was oppressing people, oppressing the truth, and forcing everyone to live under this domination, which is basically the Roman Empire, which is where we still live, within the domination of the Roman Empire. Because these are all the rules that we follow, the court system has been changed during the same time as the clocks have been changed, as the calendars have been changed, as the directions on the map have been changed. So we're living in a world that's been turned upside down, actually, and we've been denied access to the documentation of this process or to the true knowledge that was being transmitted through humanity for millennia of time. Well, I think it's an opportunity now for us to take that back. And we take it back through the connections of information, through the discernment of our own mind, and allowing ourselves to be exposed to a much broader spectrum so that we can discern what the truth really is and figure out how it is that the world got to be in such a destructive state. The number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And you can pledge at the for the larger pack at $350, the Heart of Mind Golden Wisdom Pack. And you can, for that, you receive two DVD set, Dogon Priest Spiritual Master, the two DVD set, Sidereal Calendar and Traditional Time Division, and the two CD set, Ancestors of Human Destiny, and the flash drive, the historical Heart of Mind historical document collection on flash drive, over 200 documents, 8 gigabytes of PDF documents, which include books with as many as 1,754 pages in a single document. The number is 212-209-2950. You can also call any number. Go ahead. We're going to make our transition. I'm just going to talk for as long as I can. And we're going to make, you can make any number of, you can pledge it at any level, at the $65 level for the two CD pack, Ancestors and Human Destiny. Or you can pledge at the $2 level, $110 level for the two DVD sets. The Dogon Wisdom Pack, I believe, is $225, and the Heart of Mind Golden Wisdom Pack, which includes everything, is, I believe it's $350. I'm not looking at the sheet. And so that's 212-209-2950 is your number to call for your pledge. We're down to the wire. It's just a minute more for you to make your phone call. And it's really amazing what we're hearing from the lectures of Master Naba, because he really goes into it. Remember, this is a DVD. The DVD sets, you do have the images. You have the drawings that he's making on the board when he's talking about how the calendar and how the orientation of the globe has been changed from ancient times. 212-209-2950. Let's put on a little bit of music, and that way we can make the transition to the next program. And you can continue to make your phone calls. 212-209-2950.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale, subbing for Jim Freund this evening, and doing a special edition of Hour of the Wolf. We'll be starting at 2 and going all the way until 5. So stay tuned.
I wanna be in a galaxy far away, Naboo was under an attack. And I thought me and Qui-Gon Jinn could talk the Federation into maybe cutting them a little slack. But their response, it didn't thrill us. They locked the doors and tried to kill us. We escaped from that gas, then met Jar Jar in Boss Nass. We took a bongo from the scene and we went to feed to see the queen. We all wound up on Tatooine. That's where we found this boy. Oh my. Guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Did you know this junkyard slave isn't even old enough to shave? But he can use the Force, they say. Yeah, he's probably gonna marry her someday. Well, I know he built C-3PO, and I've heard how fast his pod can go. And we were broke, it's true. So we made a wager or two. He was a prepubescent flying ace, and the minute Jabba started off that race, well, I knew who would win first place. Frankly, would have liked to stay. We all fought in that epic war, and it wasn't long at all before little Hotshot flew his plane and saved the day. And in the end, some Gungans died, some ships blew up and some pilots fried, a lot of folks were croaking, the battle droids were broken. The Jedi I admire most met up with Darth Maul and now he's toast. Well, I'm still here and he's a ghost. I guess I'll train this boy. And I was singing, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. We were singing, small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Was pitiful, couldn't have been any shyer. Mary Jane still wouldn't notice him, even if his hair was on fire. But then one day he went to that science lab, that mutated spy. There's evil doers to fight. Now Harry the rich kid's a friend of his, who horns in on Mary Jane. But to his great surprise, it seems she prefers guys who can kiss upside down in the rain. With great power comes great responsibility. That's the catchphrase of old Uncle Ben. If you missed it, don't worry, they'll say the line again and again and again. Oh, la la la, diddy-da. La la diddy da da da. Now Norman's a billionaire scientist who never had time for his son. But then something went screwy, and before you knew he was trying to kill everyone. Pretty sad day at the funeral. Norman Osborn has bitten the dust. And I heard Harry said he wants Spider-Man dead. Ah, but his buddy Pete he can trust. Da-da-dum.
We're going to have to change the system. 14-year-old's too old to be babysitting. It's not fair on her.
What'd she make you do?
Well, we listened to aggressively cheerful music sung by people chosen for their ability to dance. Then we ate cookie dough and talked about boys.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very, very sorry. But if it makes you feel any better, my fun time Buffy party night involved watching a robot throw Spike through a window. So if you want to trade...
And that was a musical medley of fun. That last bit was from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Before that was Modesty Blaze by Sparks, band out of Southern California. And then two songs by Weird Al Yankovic. One is from the Spider-Man, well, gives you the entire plot of the first Spider-Man movie, and the other one gives you the whole plot of Phantom Menace. I'm Ken Gale, and I'm subbing for Jim Ford until 5 in the morning. And
5 a.m.?
I'm dying! And that voice belongs to Mercy Van Black.
How'd you do?
And I had to play that Modesty Blaze song because it's a comic strip from England. Started in 1963. Written by Peter O'Donnell, first drawn by Jim Holdaway, mostly by Enrico Romero.
And Neville Colvin.
Yeah, he did a little bit.
A bunch of people.
It's best known for Jim Holdaway and Romero.
Yeah, amazing detail and style and beautiful backgrounds and characters. I mean, his Modesty was amazing. Gorgeous and strong, which was really neat to see.
And that's why I wanted to follow it up with some Buffy, because everybody knows her as you know, strong female character, you know, women kick ass on television. Modesty Blaze was doing that in comic strips as early as 1963. Something must have been in the air in England, because you had the Avengers start out at the same time with and remember Honor Blackman saying they didn't know how to write her, right? They didn't know how to write a woman. And she said, write it like you would for a man and let me feminize it.
Yeah, she could do it.
and so that's how the Avengers was born.
Right.
So
Emma Peel.
Starting around the same time as Modesty Blaze.
The Avengers. That was a great series. No matter who was his sidekick at the time, as it were. Mr. Steed.
Yeah. And
Patrick McNee was hilarious and very interesting and peculiar. They had all this strangeness about England that was great fun to watch. You know, the very peculiar people and societies. People who collect lions and things.
They had
a comic book story, too, once.
Oh, God. Well, yeah, that was a satire of the Batman TV show.
Whap, pow, bim.
Knocking each other about with giant poster boards that had sound effects on them.
So where was the first place you saw Modesty Blaze strips, Ken? I think I saw them in the Eclipse Comics series, Ken Pierce Books.
I first saw them because of you.
Was it I got them from Michigan that long ago?
I would see the occasional copy of the Menominee Falls Gazette, which had Modesty in it.
But
I didn't see enough of them to get into the strip. And I remember seeing the books, the novels, and being really turned off by the covers. It was basically, women in leather and
high heels and whips.
And I'm thinking, if that's what they need to sell the book, how good can it be?
That turned a couple people off. You're not the only one.
Yeah, and little did I know. Yeah, our friend Nancy, right?
Yeah.
She got turned off by those covers.
More crap.
And
no.
Never wears
heels in a fight.
I was turned off by the band Roxy Music. Same thing. If that's what you need to sell your records, then music can't be any good. You know, it was wrong in that case, too. But you were the person who really turned me on to Modesty Blaze.
Well, I had been getting for years, my friend in Michigan, Mike Kuypers, would clip them out of the Free Press in Michigan and send me the daily strips. And I've had copies of the Comics Review. They ran it for a while. Comics Review has been running it. And they made a comment in there that it's the best daily adventure strip in the world today. Because it came out every day. And telling a story like that with those little, you know, 3 or 4 panels every day is really not easy. But Pete O'Donnell made it look easy because he's so good at it. And didn't she start out as the comic strip first and then became the novels?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the comic strip was how this character started. And he would draw little thumbnails of the story, and that's how he told the story. And then he'd write, you know, he'd type it all out, what they were saying and stuff. But he would draw little scribbles, you know, just so the artist could see where things were. Yeah. And as a writer, it helped him figure out where the characters were and what they were saying.
It was, the first novel was 1965, and it was written as a result of a Modesty Blaise movie having been done.
Oh, no, not that one.
And but they actually hired Peter O'Donnell, the original writer, to do the screenplay. And then the committee took over.
Oh, God.
And dumbed it down. And then dumbed it down some more and added some stupidity, and it became a really bad movie. And there was one line of dialogue from his original script left
one
in the
line
movie.
One line was all that,
right?
Was left.
You remember the line, right?
Makes you sort of wonder whatever happened to Mr. Fothergill.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And he later used the character of Fothergill in the comic strip as
a
different character.
Oh, totally
but,
different.
He decided that he wanted
Fothergill.
Yeah, he wanted people to know what the real story was. And so he made he wrote his screenplay into a novel, and it got published, and it sold so well that they decided, hey, let's put out more.
Those books have been, I've read them over and over and over again, and it never fails to pick you up and take you on an adventure. And, you know, Modesty never gives up. Willie never gives up. They're both from, like, one's an orphan, the other one, but they both grew up without parents. And, well, that's something that Peter O'Donnell always does to his heroines.
Well, that's what fiction does.
Fiction does that, yeah. Because then they're free to go to, you know, far-flung places and learn all kinds of languages and stuff. And Willie is really, really smart, but he never went to school. He's a cockney. He grew up, you know, in an orphanage princess. And as a team, they're amazing because she looks like, you know, she's from the country club, even though she was a beggar on the streets in what was it? She grew up in the desert.
Well, she was a refugee in the Balkans.
The Balkans, okay.
Yeah, and ended up surviving. And she was based on a person, Peter O'Donnell was sort of in that basic area during World War II.
Right.
And he saw this
waif.
This waif. This
little
this,
kid in yeah, a ragged dress.
Little yeah. girl. And she was clearly fending for herself. And she had a piece of wood with a nail in it. And that's what she was carrying for a weapon.
Yeah, and you could wire... wire a nail to a piece of wood, and now you have a knife. You have a handle on a knife. You can stab with it, and it gives you more reach, so they can't get too close. She was a wildcat. She was a wild little creature.
And you know, the story of, you know, what could have happened in this war to make this little girl have to fend for herself like that.
Yeah.
And obviously deal with it, but she had this wild look in her eyes. And the image of that girl never left him, and he always thought about what happened to her, what was it like for her growing up. And out of his imagination of what happened to that girl came Modesty Blaise, who was a refugee from a war and ended up wandering around and fending for herself and meeting a old man in a refugee camp, and some people stole his food. And she defended him as if it were her food, which surprised, she was surprised at herself for that.
She says, after all, I was quite grown up by then. I could defend myself. I was 11.
and so he took her under a wing, and he was what this thing called a professor, that she didn't know what that was.
But books.
He was smart. He had books, and he taught her to read. He taught her to write. He taught her a lot of things, and she just absorbed it. And the two of them wandered around through North Africa together. And on the way to Tangier, he passed away, and she ended up going to Tangier and taking over a criminal organization.
She's all by herself.
By herself.
Yeah.
And her great, intelligence, imagination, and ability to solve problems.
Yeah, she's great at solving problems with whatever's at hand. She's a MacGyver in that. You know, she and Willie can make things when they need stuff. They figure things out with what they've got. There's one story where they're in Aladdin's cave, and they figure out, you know, how to defend themselves with junk. Basically a bunch of junk. Screws and tires.
So she takes over the gang, and by the time she was 16, she was running it, and then she turned it into an international crime organization, never dealing in
drugs or prostitution.
Drugs, prostitution, any kind of
nothing that hurts people.
Yeah, and but she sold She did a lot of espionage and
thievery. They would get
thievery.
Secrets and new machinery and then sell it to the Russians or the Americans or whatever, you know, and, or the British.
And she'd steal, you know, state secrets, and she'd always sell the secrets back to the country she stole them from.
At a good price.
Yeah, so you get first pick, and
your
if you don't get, make
key.
My money, make my price, then I'll sell it to your enemies. And so they made her price.
There you go.
And she became wealthy and then bored and retired and then got never did a crime against the United Kingdom, so she can move there.
Right. She made sure she had citizenship there.
So the first story of her is she's in her penthouse and somebody comes along and is from a unnamed secret British organization and wanted to hire her to do some stuff because they figured she must be bored. And
therein lies a tale.
Yes, and that starts the adventures. And she ended up having a partner. And this is something else in common with the Avengers TV show. A man and a woman working together, but they were not romantically involved at all. On a TV show, they made sure that he was with somebody who was married, right? It was you know, Mrs. Kathy
Mrs.
Gale and Mrs. Emma Peel.
Yes.
And so, okay, well, of course, no man would mess around with a married woman.
Wait a minute, which show are you watching? Oh, The Avengers, yes.
Yeah.
Not even when she dressed up for the Hellfire Club
yeah,
and the
right?
boots and the corset.
But
nice.
In Modesty Blaze, neither of them were married. They both had... You know, she had boyfriends, he had girlfriends, and the adventures often involved those boyfriends and girlfriends, especially her boyfriends. But
Modesty and Willie are magnets for trouble, and considering all their adventures, they certainly are. They have a million adventures. I mean, there's books and books that are... Titan's been putting out a series recently where you can get the strips, and there's still stuff I hadn't seen. After all these years of reading this and looking for it and collecting it, there's still strips that are like, oh, I never saw this one before.
And it was just...
It's so exciting.
And I really want to talk about the writing again, because one of the things about comic strips is you have three panels. And in those three panels, you have to move the story along in a way that isn't too repetitious, but is not too involved for people who maybe didn't see yesterday's paper. But also, when you introduce a character... It's very hard for you to get to know who this character is in three panels. What most comic strip writers do is they'll introduce a character and they'll make that character a stereotype. And then as the days go by, they will hone the personality of the character so that it's not a stereotype. But in order for you to get into it, they'll start with a stereotype and then make it so it's not a cliche. Peter O'Donnell doesn't do that. He gives you a character full-blown with the motivation of why the character's in the story, the personality of the character, the relationship to other characters in the story, and he can do that in three panels. And it's just an amazing thing to do. The only other comic strip writer who is anywhere near as good, and maybe even better, is Leonard Starr, who did Mary Perkins on stage, and he did... When they revived Little Orphan Annie, when the Broadway play came out, he wrote Annie. Another brilliant writer. But that's a very, very difficult thing to do.
He was amazing at
yeah,
it.
And he did it.
Amazing. He could just...
I
like to just sit down and
20
read
years.
Because you're not going to get that when they're in the newspaper, though. You have to be able to write it so you don't lose the people who are picking it up, you know.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's amazing stuff. And I'm going to put on some music I'll be back in a minute. Something came up.
Send them the atomic men to settle the storm. Meanwhile, back in the States,
And that was the 3D Invisibles, Who Watches the Watchmen. And Watchmen is my favorite graphic novel of all time, but I interrupted our rather nice conversation I was enjoying because Lister came in, and Burn Baby Burn is usually at 3 o'clock, but they changed the schedule.
Oh, nobody told him.
And nobody told him. And he came in, and he's like, I'm preempted, aren't I? And Jim Freund sent him an email. I was CC'd on it, and he did not get that.
Yeah, you don't
that.
Always get your email.
Yep.
It's the last minute.
Well, the schedule has made it the last minute,
it
too.
It
is. right now, as I sit here, I don't know if I'm on the air next Tuesday evening to do Ecologic or not.
Or the seat of the pants.
So he's over here cracking up with his usual smile. He said he'll hang out for 15, 20 minutes and go home. And I invited him to come along. Because, I mean, he's you know, listeners will say, hey, come on, we should do a show together sometime. And so, you know, we can if, you know, if you want to. And
I'd love it. Anytime. You
know. Well.
Burn, baby, burn. Burning the purest red, white, and blue flag. I'm into it. I'm totally ready.
Well, your opening song every show has Captain America in it.
You know, it's banned from WBAI, right? They got some, when BAI was at 120 Wall Street, somebody wrote in and said, don't play that song.
Oh, yeah? How come?
I got an email. I have no idea. The reason why I came here was for freedom of speech, but it's pure permitted speech.
What, did Marvel Comics come down on them for copyright?
No, it was just it's probably one of those listeners who say, go back to Cuba, now that
we can go back
to Cuba.
Yeah, now that we can, right?
Yeah.
we can go back to Cuba.
Right, we can go back to Cuba. Yeah.
Great burning there.
But they weren't, I don't think they were upset about the curse words. It was more the politics of the situation.
So
I was told to get another tune, you know.
Oh my goodness, because I remember first time I heard it, it's like, hey, Captain America's in that.
I
have a web page on my website that has a list of songs with superhero or with comic book characters in them,
right?
And that wasn't there until I heard that. It's like, yeah,
new one.
So many songs out there.
Many. I mean, that song was notorious. I mean, it was more notorious than If the Police by N.W.A. This song was put out by Clapper's Records, distributed by Relativity Records. Tor Records had this big display of the cover. And it was like overturning. This is long before Ferguson and Crown Heights, the police, turning over the police car and burning it. And they got pissed off because of the... I think 41 war, the war was coming up when they were bombing Iraq, and they decided to take the whole display out of the window because they thought that they were going to be firebombed and attacked and all of that stuff. And as a matter of fact, the record was forced not to be manufactured in this country. They forced the cover to be manufactured over in Canada. Because no company in the United States would manufacture the album cover.
So what did the cover look like?
American flag being burnt.
Oh.
And police car being turned over and burnt and that sort of stuff. And I remember when we were shooting it up in Harlem, some black veterans called the pigs on us to get us arrested in Harlem.
Oh, man.
I mean, this is so deep. You know what I mean?
Some Baptists.
Yeah, you know, this is America's version of Sharia law, you know, in Harlem. And it went on and on. And then, Busta Rhymes was the opening act for Too Black, Too Strong, because Tor Records put on some free show, you know, like what they're going to be doing with Kanye West this afternoon.
I forgot who drew it now, but it had a picture of a flag being burnt.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, this is not the American flag being burnt. This is a picture of the
American
being burnt.
Burn.
No. And he said, and if you'll notice, it's got 70 stars and 20 stripes. It's not the American flag.
Right.
And yet, this comic strip will anger a lot of people.
Really?
Just for having drawn something that has stars and stripes.
Well, that's interesting because back to the concert, the free concert that was put on by Tor Records, similar to like what they're going to do with Kanye West this afternoon in the Flatiron District. When Too Black, Too Strong came out to perform and said, F the red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America, the pigs put cuffs on him and arrested him and shut him down and threw him in jail.
Oh, boy.
And then it made the front page of the Village Voice. Can you believe that?
I can, and I'm thinking of baseball.
Uh-huh.
I'm a baseball fan, not so much modern Major League Baseball anymore, but they were one of the most important baseball movies of all time was Bull Durham, and they were going to have Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon at Cooperstown at the Hall of Fame to talk about the anniversary of the movie, 25th anniversary, I think it was. And then Cooperstown said, oh, but they're anti-war. They might say something against the war, so we can't do a celebration of this movie.
Right?
And then about a year or two later, people jumped over an outfield fence somewhere and started to burn an American flag.
Right.
And the outfielder came over and took the flag away from them and beat them up.
Right?
And they sent the flag on a tour of the United States of various baseball stadiums.
Are you serious?
And then the flag ended up in Cooperstown.
Holy.
So when the people of Cooperstown said, well, we didn't have Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins because we didn't want to politicize the Hall of Fame.
Right.
But they're okay to politicize it if it's something conservative.
Yeah.
But they're not allowed to politicize it if something conservatives hate.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say it's liberal politics, because I don't know if that's liberal politics either.
True.
Is that place financed by Texans or something?
I don't know.
Lowest common denominator?
This is America's version of Sharia law.
Sharia law, better explain that.
Well, you know, America keeps talking about they don't want Sharia law, but they're guilty of practicing it. I was just reading in the New York Times of all these places where all of these lynchings went down in the United States of America, which is no difference from what ISIL is doing right now.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And the interesting thing about the article is that, you know, in the case of the Holocaust in Germany, they made sure you never forget it by making sure you mark the spots where the crimes took place. And the article was saying, the fellow who did the research was saying that they should mark the places where all the lynchings took place in the United States of America. You know,
well,
seriously.
If they did that,
American
then
Sharia
have,
law. That's what
if,
I'm.
If they about. Marked every place where there was a gay bashing, for example,
exactly,
and a gay person got killed,
exactly,
there'd be an awful lot of markers all over the place. I mean, you figure all the lynchings,
some kind
all
of red, white, and blue, right?
Gay bashings and all the other kinds of hate crimes.
Yeah.
If they were all marked, there'd be markings everywhere.
Yeah. Well, there's no difference between the lynching and the gay crime and all that stuff because. What I usually say on Burn Baby Burn, which pisses off all the black people who want to kill me, is the fact that they have not, the only thing they have not done is to burn the cross on gay people's lawns.
Ooh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really sad, but hey, a change is coming. I can smell it.
Of hate. We have this great history and tradition of hate in this country.
Yeah. Did you see the gay couple that got married in Alabama?
Yeah.
That was really cool.
And of course, there's a judge who won't obey the law because he doesn't like the law. So, I'm above the law. I don't have to obey the ones that I don't like.
Isn't that the judge who took the Ten Commandments out of his AS squared and says he's going to put it in the middle of the court, right?
The same judge.
That was the same judge. Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It never stops.
Wow. No, it doesn't.
That's what Lister calls American Sharia law.
It is pretty amazing. And it's hard. We started out talking about comic books today, right? And playing Weird Al Yankovic's science fiction satire and comic book satire and having a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, WBAI is a political station. And it's not often that two producers get together on the microphone over the air at the same time.
Yeah. I was trying to do this with you at WUSB. You got to come do the Saturdays Apart to WUSB show.
And
seriously.
Well, you didn't get Jim's email, but when you do look at your email, you'll see I'm CC. So we can now communicate with each other by email.
Excellent.
And we can figure out a time.
Yep. I heard Brian Williams is coming to BA. Is it true?
I have no idea.
Ooh.
I'm not in the loop.
Ooh.
I'm not in the loop.
That loop will hang you. I'm glad you're not in the loop.
Oh. That would be Sherry Loa.
Oh, boy. What am I going to say to that?
Right. Yeah.
That's a good line for anybody. If people say they're not in the loop.
Keep you hanging is not good.
Right.
So next time you're at work and somebody's saying, I'm not in the loop, tell them that's
good. Glad you're not in that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I saw an some commercial the Marvel people come out with some movie. Have you seen that lately?
They're always coming out with movies. Well,
they're
always
coming out
corporate
movies,
thing.
Yeah.
It's their business now. The comic books are like to get ideas ready that they can present as storyboards for movies.
Wow.
Yeah, they've gone totally for movies because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. That's where people go for entertainment.
Yeah.
It's the movies.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So the woman who stepped down from Sony, she'll be doing some Marvel comic super movie too.
Well, there's always. I mean, superheroes especially are mm-hmm. huge in Hollywood.
Well, that lady who played the Black Widow in the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of her name.
Is that Scarlett Johansson? Or
Scarlett.
Is that,
yeah. She was in another movie where she was like incredibly amped up and she just was going at everything at 90 miles an hour. And it was like being Black Widow, because they didn't make a Black Widow movie. And this is where they fall apart. It's like, where are the women superheroes? Well, there's one in every group of five guys. That's Marvel Comics. You know, they don't have a lot of women, supposedly, to put in their books.
But, of course,
the
they do if they were to pay more attention.
Yeah, well, the Widow was hot
and,
in Avengers.
At one point, when women complained that there were not any, you know, these superhero movies are coming out from Marvel and none starring women, they said, well, we can only do two a year, and so, you know, we have to cover the major characters who are men. And then when they started doing three a year,
and
people said, hey, how come you're doing all guys? And you said that when you were doing two a year, you couldn't. Now you're doing three a year. Why can't you fit in? And they were like, well, you know, we still have to, you know, and we have to do the sequels of the males. And they kept making excuses. It's very bizarre.
But isn't it easy to convert one of those men into a woman, and the story goes on?
Which they've done, but not
They had
not
Storm
in
dressed up in the Thor costume. She had Thor powers for a while. You know, they have other people being the superheroes. Yeah.
And, well, they starred Wolverine in his own movie from, you know, spinning off from the X-Men movies, but not Storm.
Right.
Storm should have had a movie right
And,
there.
In fact, Storm had a much greater role in the comic books than she ever did in the movies.
She's mm-hmm. one of the leaders.
And Holly Berry got very, very angry because she's read the comics.
Right.
And she knew how good the character was, and she was quite happy to play that character.
That's true.
Until she saw the scripts and she realized how badly they were writing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she teaches at the school, but she never gets to be the leader. It's always Charles. Yeah. It's like, no, that's not the way the books are, you know?
and that's part of the problem, is people judge the comic books by the movies. So if the movies are stupid, oh, then the comic books must be stupid. You know, and if the movies are sexist, oh, well, then the comic books must be sexist.
Yeah,
no, not true.
Yeah.
You know, read the source
comic
material.
Comic books, do they still
Please,
make those?
Read the source material, everybody.
Do they still make comic books?
Hey, comic books matters just like Black Lives Matters. My name is not Prince. Yeah.
Well,
I just got a graphic novel recently about the soldiers in World War II in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to mix up all the facts. But Buffalo Soldiers? No, that's from the West.
No,
this is the Harlem Firefighters.
Really?
And it was a whole troop of black men who were in the war. And it's a whole graphic novel.
Well, yeah, because it was a segregated service.
Yeah.
There's this, the, you know, baseball got desegregated before the armed services were.
The Harlem Hellfighters. It's really great. It's a whole graphic novel, the story of these guys. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff, it's like, the thing about comic books that's so important is it gives you words and pictures. So you're reading, which is really good, because a lot of stuff people do is reading.
Sure.
But it also has the pictures. If you're not sure of the word, you can figure it out. I mean, I learned French from comic books because I would get to these words I didn't know and I'd look it up. And Superman with his super vitesse. I was the first one in my French class who knew what vitesse meant because it was super speed. You know, the super vitesse, you know, oh, that's speed. And they're like, what? Like, well, it was in the comic book I was reading that I got, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I'm always saying you should read the source material, read the comic books. And, you know, they're not stupid. Some of the TV, if you ever watched the Batman TV show, you'd never want to pick up a comic book because it was so dumb. But, you know, Robin was cute. What are you going to do? And but, you know, to read something and have a picture there helps you. But it also, it's like when you're watching a movie, you can pause it now and come back to it. But it's still not, you know, everything's there. You know exactly what the character looks like. But when you're reading something and the way there's the panels in between that you sort of have to fill in the action.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a lot more activity for your mind to do reading comic books than it is to watch a movie.
And it's more than just the in-between the panels that you fill in, because when you have two people having dialogue in the same panel, Well, obviously, that's not a slice in time. That's a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the body language and the expression may or may not match what they're saying. You know, you may have the body language in reply to the comment, and then the dialogue comes after that. And you sort of do that automatically with your mind. You're not thinking, now, which comes first, the body language or the dialogue? You just know, because you know people and you know how things work. And artists take advantage of that, sometimes not even conscious on their part.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to use a lot more of your mind to read a comic book than to sit and watch a movie.
True.
In fact, I know some people who say they can't read comics because the pictures and the words confuse them, because they want to go and look at the pictures, then they want to go and read the words. They can't put those things together, which really baffles me. I never heard, like, what? But I've had a couple people now tell me that they can't put them together, and I'm like, oh, it's a shame, because it's great.
My grandfather was like that.
Yeah.
He couldn't read comics. He said the word balloons drove him crazy. And
they want to watch something.
When my first story was published and I showed him the script, he loved the script.
Yeah.
And he's like, this could be a real story. I says, it is a real story. It got published. I got paid for it. It's a real story.
I'm so sorry, Dad.
But he couldn't think of something being drawn as being a real story for some reason.
Well, I can tell you how I used to do comics. I used to just run through it and look through the pictures and enjoy it and then start back from the top and just read it.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's how I used to do it.
It
was even double fun.
Artists are taught that you should be able to tell what's going on
exactly,
in the story without the words.
Right, right.
You know, your job is to tell the story.
That's fun, yeah. You get a whole
and don't rely on the dialogue. The dialogue should enhance your art. I mean,
true.
This is clearly an art-oriented way of looking at the combination of words and pictures.
Yeah.
Because a writer is like, you know, tell the story with the words, and the artist will enhance it.
And sometimes when I looked at the particular character and I wanted to know a little bit more detail, then I'd go down and just sneak and read up some stuff and keep flowing with the flow of the comic. You know, it was fun.
And also, well, I mean, not so much anymore, but there was a time that there was letter pages in comic books where you could have supplemental information about the character or the world or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When Mercy and I were doing Evolution Comics, we took advantage of that.
Great.
And we had all this, you know, it was all this Celtic mythology and history in the letter page.
Because
if you throw it all in the story, it sort of interrupts
the
flow.
No room for the artwork.
But there's still people. If they're buying a Celtic science fiction comic, they probably are somewhat interested or becoming interested. So you put that in a letters page.
Sure.
And, you know, movies don't have letters pages. They have fan pages where they talk about who's married and divorced and no information on,
well, you
on,
say how,
on the world.
With the Vitrix the Druid, it's real Celtic mythology, not Disney Druids, because they don't have time when it's in a movie to do all this detail.
Yeah,
they
don't
have time and they're animated and they don't want to draw the Celtic worlds, you know. It's too complicated. It's like, you know, they just can't draw all that. In a cartoon, you know, it's much simpler. I mean, they're much more complicated cartoons these days, but still.
Speaking about that, are there any new, like, you know, totally revolutionized comics coming out now?
Independent comics always have new.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Harlem Hellfighters, that's a graphic novel comic that just came out.
Yeah.
Actually,
they
have graphic novels now at Barnes & Noble and in your library. You go to the library.
That's
and
true.
Get all
libraries
kinds of neat
have
stuff.
Them.
They have them up on the shelf. You can go pick down and look at things and think you like.
Yeah, and it is amazing what's out there. You know, the corporate comics or superheroes have kind of taken them over, and if they do a non-superhero comic, they're taking a big chance business wise, so they don't take the chance.
Mm-hmm.
Independent comics can do everything, so that's where you have fiction. That's where you have nonfiction. That's where you have detectives and science fiction and everything else.
Things that are sort of like blogs, like people doing their diary of their life, you know?
Yeah.
They write their whole life out and draw pictures.
So if there's a genre you're interested in, other than superheroes, but you still like that combination of words and pictures, go to a decent comic book store and ask them, you know, what they have that's whatever. You like detective stories? Detective stories do you have? You
because
like
when I was last...
Sports, ask them what they have.
Because when I was last in Nippon, which is Japan, it was like tons of comics.
Oh, yeah.
Which was great, you know? I mean, it was like, you know, this seems normal, you know? It was great.
40% of...
publication?
All published material in Japan by volume is comics. 25% by money.
Yeah.
Because comics are cheaper than books.
Yeah.
But, I mean, That's a lot of stuff. 40% of what's published is comics. And everybody reads them.
Yep.
You know, there's none of this, like, only you know, young people read them or whatever. It's everybody.
I used to wonder, you know, in Jamaica we have the Daily Gleaner, which is equivalent to the New York Times. I used to wonder, this is how I was, like, freaking out when I saw Into Comics. Why is it they don't do the whole New York Times, like, a comic?
You know, there's a rumor that by the time they realized that comic books help newspapers sell, everything had been taken. There was nothing left for them. They had the dregs, so they said, okay, well, we're not going to do any comics at all, and we'll say it's because we're intellectuals and we'll appeal to the snobs and everything else. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a great story.
Yeah.
Because certainly comic strips do help newspapers sell, or they did.
Yeah.
I don't know if they do anymore.
Well, I could take my New York Times in comic form.
Well, there's a lot of people who do comic strips on what's going on today, making comments.
Great.
You know, a lot of the weeklies, you know, the Ted Rawl and Tom Tomorrow and
you can go online and look at comic strips, too, because, like, they run them through some of the papers, but they're so small, you know, and if you want to really look at it, it's nice. You can go on the computer and find these things at the syndicates and read Rose's Rose or Mutz, you know, and can catch them there. And also, Mutz has been collected into a lot of little booklets, which you can get at the library. Or Barnes and Noble, those kind of places.
Great.
Yeah, they're fun.
Well, I'm going to have to run back to Brooklyn, before it freezes.
Good idea. I'm glad you could join us.
Yeah, well, I hope you guys come join me on WSB 12 noon to 3 on Saturday, Sábado. You know, seriously.
Okay. Yeah. USB?
Yeah, Stony Brook University.
Stony Brook, that's quite a ways.
yeah. But if you can get over the hill to come up to BEI, you know, at 137th Street, you can go anywhere.
Yeah, right. That's true. That's quite a hill. I'm glad it wasn't icy.
Yeah.
Oy, oy, oy.
Yeah. All right. Merci beaucoup, monsieur.
Et bientôt.
Oui. Au revoir.
On suit.
Oui.
Okay. Thank you, Lister. And so Burn Baby Burn follows Jim Freund normally from 3 a.m. until 5 a.m. And, so you better hear him. Oh, got to get a hug. Got to get a hug.
A manly hug.
Bye.
Yay. Yeah, better get home before it starts freezing. It's going to go cold tonight, I think. It's supposed to snow a little, but not much.
Yeah.
Not like they got in Boston. Speaking of Boston.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about an anthology comic book?
Yeah.
You have a copy or two there of which?
Yeah.
And should we pitch or something? It's like 5 of 3.
Oh, that's right. We should be pitching.
If you want to hear more great programs like this on WBAI.
Now, I'm hoping that the call center is working, because the show before this was
Kathy
pitching
Davis?
Using this number, 212-209-2950. Support WBAI. Support programming that you don't find anywhere else. I mean, literally anywhere else. things on comics these days are mostly reviews of new stuff. And after a while, the person doing the show is like, I don't want to read anymore. You'll find...
with all that history?
Yeah, on the web, you'll find some interviews with writers and artists and articles and things like that, but nothing on radio. We're doing stuff that is quite unique. And
we
somewhat
want to support
important.
212-209-2950 to pledge some money to WBI to keep shows like this on the air. Keep WBA on the air. WBI.
And 212-209-2950. And you can become a BAI buddy, so you can pledge, you know, $10 a month, $15 a month, you know, whatever is comfortable for you. Whatever is you figure, I'll never notice. And do that, but pledge to your favorite show, Hour of the Wolf, and we're going until 5. I'm not sure how they're working things as far as crediting Jim with raising the money, but Jim Freund does an incredible, incredible show where he interviews writers of science fiction novels, short stories, you name it. And you really get to explore the creative process and what goes into making a story, making a book, and what goes into getting it published. And He's got an absolutely wonderful show, and I feel quite privileged that he wants me to host it for him. That's really kind of neat. But he's here from 1:30 to 3 every week, and so we started at 2, and I just hope that not too many of his audience that tuned in at 1:30 and went, oh, he's not on again this week. And I hope some of them came back and tried to see if there's anything going on, because, hey, there is.
Talking Comics.
And, yeah, it was neat, Talking Comics with Lister.
Yeah, cool. Different way of reading comics. It's like, yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I like that.
And, yeah, when you're talking...
There are some comic books, I don't read them. I just look at the pictures because I can't stand the writing. And there's other ones I can't read, even though Ken tells me the writing's so great because I can't stand the art. And it's terrible. I can't look at it. Ugh. If it bothers me, if the anatomy's all, ugh, I can't look. It's like, ugh, I can't read it. And Ken's like, oh, this writer. And I'm like, ugh, the art. It's terrible. But it happens.
Yep. And there's a lot of great art that I couldn't put up with because the writing was so bad.
Yeah.
And I know, and right now I'm so tempted to mention some of those writers' names, but I won't. I don't want, for one, I don't want to single them out as if they're the only bad writers out there. Unfortunately, no. There's plenty of that to go around.
So call 212-209-2950, please. Pledge to keep WBI on the air, keep shows like this coming out there and driving you crazy at 3 in the morning. 3 in the morning? Hmm. Not quite, but it will be.
You know, we were talking about Modesty Blaise, the British comic strip.
Modesty Blaise.
And she's very, very popular in the Scandinavian countries, which always fascinated me. I don't know a whole lot about what the culture of Scandinavia is that would make her so popular. And she's also very popular in South American countries. Hmm. And, you know, the cliche is, you know about macho men and things like that, and here's a woman running the world, the Modesty Blaise universe. And
it's cool.
And yet, and also, those are two extremes, right? Scandinavia, South America.
Yeah.
Very different.
The Ice Age to the jungle.
Yeah, you know, cultures and ever different worlds, and yet Modesty Blaise is incredibly popular in both places. And I know that one of the reasons that she was not syndicated very much in the United States is because of the censorship in American newspapers.
Oh, yeah. She runs around naked a lot.
And even though it's not...
If you have to go swimming, you don't really want to be wearing clothes, you know. It's like she doesn't have a swimsuit, so she's out there naked. And this seems fine to the British papers.
And yeah,
they have real problems here.
And it's not like it's erotic. I mean, you know, she's swimming. Usually it's from the back.
In the Michigan paper, when they'd print those, they'd put a little bikini on her with big polka dots. They'd draw something on her so she wasn't naked. And it had big string ties. Like, the artist was complaining that they had to do this. It's like, let's make it as annoying as possible. It's like, yeah, really. It's annoying.
And it'll show, you know, Modesty is taking a shower. And, of course, the water is going across her in such a way that... it's already censored, and yet they feel a need to have her wearing a bathing suit while she takes a shower because it's an American newspaper.
This country was founded by people who wanted religious freedom. The freedom they wanted religious freedom with was Puritanism.
And so the Detroit newspaper, which was the only newspaper publishing Modesty Blaise
for years,
Detroit Free Press.
Yeah.
And the newspaper editor, a comic strip editor, complained that he had to deal with Modesty Blaise differently, except that he would get so many complaints if it was canceled that
they
kept running it until Peter O'Donnell retired.
That was great.
And it's kind of strange, the kind of censorship that happened. So I think that's one of the reasons that no comic strip editor wanted to put up with the censorship that he knew we would have to do. And certainly comic strips might be the most censored medium in America, more censored than television, even. I mean, there was a time when comic strips, the babies were not allowed to come from pregnant mothers. Nobody was ever pregnant in a comic strip because they somehow felt this was bad. Yeah, they couldn't show it. They couldn't mention it. for a long time. And so babies kept getting adopted. They would just show up on the doorstep. They would, I guess, materialize, you know, from the Enterprise. Just materialize, and there'd be a baby on the doorstep, and suddenly you had a son or a daughter. And that's where all the babies came from for a really long time. I think Gasoline Alley may have been the first comic strip that had a pregnant person in it.
Wow, that's weird.
Took a long time. And just,
censorship is just so weird.
It is. I mean, where did they think babies came from?
I know.
Well, I guess they came from baskets.
A cabbage patch.
It was just amazing.
Thork, there's this bird that shows up on your roof, except that only works in Sweden and Holland. They don't really have storks on the roof here.
If you have to deal with that as a comic strip editor, you're certainly not going to want to deal with what Modesty Blaze had in it. But it was definitely for older set. The Evening Standard, where she first appeared as a conservative newspaper, so they didn't have a problem, but conservative newspapers here would certainly have a problem. They didn't have a problem with a strong female character either, which is interesting all in itself. But I would highly recommend any of the reprint editions that Titan Books is doing, or any of the novels.
And the Comics Review, if you can find old back issues of that magazine, there's strips in there.
Yeah, I think it'd be easier to find the Titan reprint books than
Comics Review are from like the 80s, I guess.
I don't know if the novels are still in print or not, but there's...
Oh, that's a good question. I bet they are. Also, he did a bunch of romance novels under a different name, which are also amazing adventure stories with women. And a lot of his characters end up with the guy at the end or get married, and sometimes they don't. But they have adventures. They go to India. They go to Sri Lanka and Tibet. You know, it's amazing adventures. And some of the characters remind you of certain people whose initials might be MB.
Like
Willie.
The name of the author.
And the name of the author's initials are MB, which is interesting, too. Madeline Brent. There's like five of them, and they're really amazingly well-written. It was hard to find them because a lot of people don't think much of romance novels. You know, Harlequin and stuff. You know, that's not... good fiction. I guess it's sort of junk food. But you know, the people, a lot of people love it, too. So.
And certainly none of the characters were stereotypes.
No, not in his books. Her books. Madeline Brent.
Yeah,
books.
Right. Her, yes. Yeah, I mean, she's got a little biography and everything else.
Cute. Really cute. It's like under the facade of... Whoa. But yeah, it's amazing the output of his career. I mean, all these stories that I'm still coming on, ones I've never seen before that I just didn't pick up before, you know. They're still coming out, you know, just reprinting all these things. Volumes and volumes. And then the novels. And then he had time to write some other novels under a different name because he wanted to go off in that direction, you know. It's amazing how prolific.
And he had separate continuities in the novels and the comic strips.
Yeah. They overlapped for devices, but there were very few. I don't think there was maybe one story.
Well, toward the end of the novelizations, he started to overlap with the comic strips more.
Yeah.
And it was interesting in that the he fleshed out the characterization of everybody a lot better.
Although, like the Colliers,
Colliers
are much better characters in the novels, yeah.
And so that was kind of fun. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale, and on the phone with me is...
Mercy Van Vleck.
And you want to tell people about yourself?
Hoya moya. Well, I've been a comic book fan since the 60s when I discovered Nick Carty. Carty, 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 Carty! And I used to read the 80-page Giants that were 25 cents for 80 pages of Batman and Robin stories. And I've been involved in fandom forever. I used to show up at conventions dressed as various members of the Legion of Superheroes. And I would meet all the Legion fans that way, because they'd say, Phantom Girl, when did you get here? And I said, well, I'm here on planetary leave from the Legion. And then I've done comic books for Evolution Comics. I've done inking for DC and Defiant, all kinds of different peoples. And I've been involved in doing our own comics, Evolution Comics, where I did Green Ghost and Lotus, which was written by Tom and Mary Beerbohm. And I still do conventions. We do Aresia every year, where we talk about comics and Wonder Woman. We always have a panel about Wonder Woman. Funny thing about that. And out and about, as they say, I always have stuff in the art show there. And this year I had some superhero things. I had Aquaman meets the Bubble Guppies, which was very strange drawing. One of Ken's ideas. We like to cross over, you know, like Wolverine meets the Pokemon characters. You know, they're yellow. They have those stripes on them, just like Wolverine, and they have pointy ears. But he says they're not related.
And Mercy Van Vlack has been on Hour of the Wolf with me a few times in the past. And we can take listener phone calls anytime you want, or break from music whenever you need a break. You can have input into this, Mercy.
Eek. Scheduling. Indeed.
And yeah, I was just, you know, looking, and Nick Carty passed away in you know, 2013.
It's been a while now.
A year and a half now, and it doesn't seem like that long.
You know, he went through the war. That was that thing where guys went off. Which war was that? I can't keep track.
He was with World War II.
They went off to World War II. He worked for Fiction House, and he worked with Eisner's studio, Will Eisner. And he went off to war, and then this gal, Lily Renee, took over his art chores on Fiction House, doing Senorita Rio, which is one of my, you know, seminal characters that I've always liked to draw on and look at. And I found out years later it was Nick Carty. It's like, oh, yeah, of course it is. But, you know, she's from the 50s, and she was a spy and a daredevil, and she would get in adventures in South American countries, and she knew how to ride horses, and she was a spy.
Hey, elements of Modesty Blaise in that description.
She could sword fight. You know, she was an adventuress, yeah. And the thing was, back
except
then...
Except she predated Modesty by a good 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. But what they did back then was they had a lot of what they would call pin-up shots and good girl art. And a lot of showing the garters. Like, for some reason, this was really hot stuff. The top of the stockings, you know. And they would always try to get her dumped in the river so that her clothes would be, like, wet. You know, the wet T-shirt look. Because they didn't have Playboy yet. So the guys would be reading something to have something fun, and they would pick up comic books. They didn't have Playboy. This was back in the 50s. And so this was their pinup art. You know, as gals in comic books. You know, like the Dragon Lady in Steve Canyon was a pinup, as well as a comic. And that's when that's sort of what got me into doing Miranda the Tease for Leg Show magazine. That's right, I also did Miranda, and I did it for Puritan magazine with Ken writing the stuff. So we actually had stories instead of just stream of unconsciousness.
And it's interesting in talking about, you know, didn't have Playboy, when you think, well, that's clearly that's older readers. And it's like, yeah, that is older readers.
Guys in the trenches are reading comic books.
Yeah, in World War II, one of the major forms of reading was comic books. You know, the soldiers used to say it relieved the tension. It got them, you know, out of the war for the 20 or 30 minutes it took to read. There were 64 pages in those days.
Mm.
And just hundreds of thousands of, or probably millions of comic books went overseas to Europe and the Pacific. And when the soldiers came back, they still read comics. Well, now they're older. And so, of course, being good business people, the comic book companies made older comics, things
your
for
market.
Older readers. And they knew that. And there wasn't this thing about, because some comics are for kids, all comics are for kids. But there's always a parent group that will look at it that way.
Yeah.
And so if because one of the problems, of course, is that if a child has a dime, which is what they cost in the 40s, and that means he can buy a comic book for himself, and he's not necessarily going to choose, or she, what her parents would choose for him or her.
Mm-hmm.
So that would get the parents upset. And, of course, instead of talking to their child, they want to ban the comic book the child bought.
Right. Get rid of them all.
And it seems to be unique here in the United States, because they don't have this problem in Europe and Japan and
it's
South
something
America.
Something about children's literature, bad. Remember the pulps? That was children's literature. Bad. Get rid of them. They're terrible.
And people
violent.
Can't seem to distinguish between a medium that children like and a medium that is not for children. And eventually it led to Senate hearings in 1954.
The Kefauver hearings.
And suddenly, I mean, I talk about this almost every time I come on Hour of the Wolf, but it took the maturity of comics. The comics for older readers were gone. They were just gone. And it was,
They lost the female market.
And yeah, the female market was
gone.
A lot
of the women were buying the horror comics because they thought they were fun. They liked the horror comics, and they were gone. They couldn't do anything about horror or werewolves or vampires.
And it's interesting in that when back in the early or mid-70s, DC Comics decided they would try to sell comic books like ice cream. And they had a truck they called the Comic Mobile that drove around Long Island and sold comics that way. And the people,
sometimes his wife dressed up as Wonder Woman.
Well, it turns out that she wasn't his wife at the time.